On April 2nd, Drummond Fraser will be speaking at Arbor Gallery as part of the speaker series. Drummond's talk will focus on events in Afghanistan during a critical period of change in the mission, involving a surge of American forces into southern Afghanistan, Canadian forces realignment in Kandahar province, and early preparation for a change in mission. This was also a period of time that saw a significant increase in the level of violence, changes in the perceptions and attitudes of the Afghan population, and a series of Afghan general elections. However, there is a backstory to both the Afghan conflicts and the Canadian forces' development in prior missions and during the Afghan mission that enabled Canada to play such a critical role in the conflict. This backstory will inform a good part of Fraser's talk at Arbor Gallery, and of course, it's an area that we will bring up during our interview. Just a short note on Drummond Fraser's bio. Major Drummond Fraser is an infantry officer who has served 28 years in the Canadian Army, including several domestic operations and overseas deployments to the Balkans and Afghanistan. He has enjoyed a diverse career, approximately one-third of which included service in regular and reserve force units, one-third in staff and planning positions, up to and including 1st Canadian Division Headquarters, the Canadian Army Headquarters, and National Defence Headquarters, and one-third in the Canadian Army and Canadian Armed Forces training system, teaching and training future generations of soldiers and leaders, and periodically preparing civilians for working in deployed environments. On overseas deployments, Fraser was frequently employed working closely with host nation forces and in close contact with local national populations. Pre-deployment training for these missions included intense cultural and language immersion for both the Balkans and Afghanistan. He also worked very closely with allied military forces, international and non-governmental organizations, and with local organizations and authorities. Fraser says he was privileged during deployments in both regions to have very close contact with the realities of the on-the-ground situation and the local population, as well as the responsibility to advise and inform operational and sometimes strategic decision-makers and their staff. This offered opportunities for him to gain some unusual insight into the context of these conflicts. Although still a serving Canadian officer and speaking about operational experience in Afghanistan in particular, Fraser will be speaking as a private citizen and not as a spokesperson for the Canadian Armed Forces or National Defence. We start our conversation with the situation in 2009 and 2010. Fraser was deployed to southern Afghanistan as an acting lieutenant colonel embedded with Afghan National Security Forces and commanding an international team mentoring Afghan police, army, border services, and intelligence services. With such a complex subject on the table, I let Drummond choose where this conversation should start.
You know, I think the right place to begin with is Afghanistan in 2009, 2010. And paint a picture of what that environment was like for Afghans, for Canadians, for the coalition, and for the conflict as a whole. But I think in order to provide a proper understanding for why things were where they were and why that was a very important period of time, you need to back up and back up in a number of different directions.
I was just going to say, I'm sure, you know, a lot of people would need it to be connected to 9/11 because it seems to us, from our perspective, that's where things started. I know the Russians were in Afghanistan even before that, but give us a context maybe on that scale.
Well, you're absolutely correct on both of those. For many people in the West, particularly in North America, Afghanistan begins not long after 9/11. But, of course, the story, in fact, goes much further back than the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan in the 70s, particularly from an Afghan perspective. So from an Afghan perspective, there is a very long history of foreign intervention into their country, and often by the same players.
Why is that? Is it geographically? Are they a trade route or some? What's the reason why?
It is one of those critical places where the Silk Road passed through. So it's a transit route east and west and north and south. It connects Central Asia, the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent. It's also a meeting ground of many, many different cultures, including the Pashtun and some of the other Afghan populations who are in fact Indo-European in origin.
Okay.
And so you have long-standing, very different cultural traditions.
Mm-hmm. And how much is a fact is a the what would you call it? I mean, the poppy fields and the heroin trade and that kind of thing, is that a relatively recent thing, or is that a long-standing element, I guess, in the Afghani economy, for lack of a better word? Has that been there a long time, and is that a factor as well?
Well, there's a record of poppies and drug use from that part of the world that goes back a very long time. That's a significant portion of the economy and something that would contribute to a lot of political instability. It dates to the Soviet incursion.
Okay, interesting. So all of these elements, it's really helpful to put these in perspective and understand what the forces were that created this hotspot in the world that continues to this day, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess we could just leap forward here, because we are trying to do a really quick overview of what you're going to be presenting in much greater detail at Arbor Gallery at the speaker series. Can we skip forward to what Canada's interest and role in this is? Is this a good point to sort of jump in from our national perspective? And
Well, that's probably not something that I'm going to focus on. That falls more in the realm of policy decisions by government, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I'm a soldier. When the military is tasked with an operation like this, it provides, through the Chief of Defense Staff, advice to government on what are viewed as the best avenues to pursue a policy, what the risks are, what the capacities of the military are.
Right.
But ultimately, it's a government decision.
What you're saying is that it's not up to the military to question the policy, why you're going into the country, but just how best to actually implement or achieve, I guess, the policy that the government has established. But I guess I'm saying, from the Canadian Forces perspective, we did play a critical role there, right?
We did. Yeah. And a lot of the capacity of the Canadian Forces and also other government departments that were present, because this was a whole of government effort. You had Foreign Affairs very heavily present. Mm-hmm. You had CEDA, Canadian International Development Agency, very heavily present. You had Corrections Canada and Border Services, and a wide variety of agencies that were all contributing.
And even representatives from some police forces, I think, at one point.
Absolutely, The RCMP, but there are also representatives from provincial and municipal police forces across the country.
Yeah, quite amazing deployment, yeah. So
a lot of the contribution that was made there was because the incredible impact that Canadians had in Kandahar province in particular, but throughout Afghanistan, were by virtue of a lot of Canadian experience in previous operations in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. In particular, I think the experience in the Balkans helped to inform a lot of the approach that ended up being taken.
But is that not harking back to a time of the Blue Berets? I mean, you know, we did have a reputation for being, you know, peacekeepers. Mm-hmm. This has got to come up right in this situation, because it seems the general impression, I think, is that we sort of gave up our role as peacekeepers in the Afghani war and the war in Afghanistan, and started becoming, you know, heavily involved in frontline activities and combat. Is that a mistaken impression, or is
I think it draws rigid distinctions between things that are in fact representative of a spectrum,
a continuum kind of thing.
Yes,
that's
interesting. And so, you know, Canadians in Afghanistan had to be good at combat. They also had to be very good at governance, had to be very good at reconstruction, had to be very good at positively interacting with with the local population and establishing trust with a very different culture.
All elements of peacekeeping, really.
Well, peacekeeping, you know, is distinct in that it usually refers to a case where you've got two established states that have agreed to a ceasefire or a cessation of hostilities,
yes.
are jointly requesting
A third party
to come in.
And that didn't apply to Afghanistan, obviously.
It doesn't apply to Afghanistan, although interestingly, the Afghans would frequently repeat that the Taliban were a foreign organization, and they very much saw a lot of what was going on as the intervention of other countries. That it often had the appearance of something that was domestic, and there was a lot of domestic players in Afghanistan, but they did see this as the hostile intent of some of their neighbors.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So, so in that kind of situation, the international forces coming in were serving as, I want to say mediators, that's not quite the right word, but playing an intercessionary role between the invaders, in quotes, and the local people? Is that
in early 2009 when I arrived, there was a tremendous effort to do polling to get a good idea of what the Afghan civil population's attitudes were across the country. And of course, there's nuance depending on where you are geographically and urban and rural. But at the time, about 80% of the population were polling in favor of coalition involvement. Presence. But they didn't, you know, they did not see this at that time as an invasion. And the intent, and I think at least for the beginning of 2009 and the years leading up to it, the perception of much of the Afghan population was that the international involvement was enabling a reestablishment of civil society in Afghanistan.
Okay. And then you mentioned in your press release about the event that there was kind of a shift in attitude around that time, and that the attitude of the population started tipping in the direction of resentment and that kind of thing.
The Afghan population, and this is grossly generalizing,
yes,
but the Afghan population was getting increasingly exhausted and losing their patience with a lot of what they were experiencing, where they really felt squeezed between very violent pressures from different actors in their country. And your average Afghan was interested in raising his family, having a, you know, a safer, brighter, more economically viable future. And we're constantly being pushed or pressured into involvement in a conflict that they weren't particularly interested in. Mm-hmm. And the violence level was rising dramatically in 2009, 2010. Some of that was associated with the first general elections for the Afghan presidency.
Right.
And the Taliban and other insurgent groups were violently opposed to that. And you also had a surge of military forces into foreign military forces into Afghanistan, which also meant a lot more contact between the insurgents and members of the coalition and the international community. So the violence ramped up, and that couldn't help but have a collateral impact on the and the local population.
On the population, yeah. This would be the famous, I guess, surge that Obama initiated. Was that right around 2009, 2010?
Like the Canadian experience, a lot of the decision making concerning Afghanistan crosses party boundaries and different elected governments in both the United States and Canada, and that was true in some places in Europe as well. So there's a continuum of policy,
right,
regardless of the party in power. But yes, there was a surge of the Americans had been, of course, always heavily present in the mission.
Yes,
the majority, and particularly in command positions, and at the national level. At the tactical level, the Americans were primarily in the East, prior to 2009. But in 2009, there was a heavy surge of American forces into the South.
Okay.
And the forces that were present in the South, the British in Helmand Province, Canadians in Kandahar, the Dutch and Australians in Oregon, it was very difficult with the troop strengths present, to have the presence and density that was required to fully engage with the range of problems that we were dealing with. So the Americans brought critically needed resources, but it was a massive change in the environment. Violence across the spectrum of violence, from political violence through to combat, had been present very heavily up to 2009. The spike was very, very dramatic.
By virtue of having so many more armed soldiers, on the ground, it would just happen. I've said that as a civilian without much knowledge of that, but it just, I guess if you put people in a location like that, it's just going to spike everything, right? It's just going to escalate everything, the contacts between the forces and that kind of thing. I just wanted to go back a second. It's a surprise to me to hear that they would have actually polled the population. Who would have sponsored that polling? Would that have been the United Nations or the coalition?
That's a good question. I know that it was Afghan nationals that were doing it, and they were doing it door to door. It was well coordinated with the government and with the coalition, but it was done in a way that seemed to enable it to happen even in areas where the government didn't have control of the population.
Wow, that's quite impressive. It's good to know that kind of thing happens, because it's obviously critical to get a really accurate, finger on the pulse of the actual population that we're, serving. I say in air quotes because. Maybe not all actions are serving them. We're viewing this from the outside, and we're descending on a nation. So to take the time to actually, hear how your presence is being viewed and what the attitude of the people is would be really, really critical. Not only, it would have a huge impact on how you're received, right, and whether they're going to cooperate with you or not.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, the polling numbers were a very, very useful tool at the operational and strategic level for decision making. But of course, when you had platoon commanders, company commanders, and their troops deployed in a district or part of a city, their day to day business was about engaging with the Afghan population and the civil authorities the majority of the effort that was done there always had the civil population as a centerpiece to the planning. That's also true for the insurgents. That's the nature of an insurgency. It's a political fight. It's a very violent political fight.
And they would work with or through or the civil authorities as well, or impose their will on them.
Well, the Taliban is the Taliban in particular being the largest insurgency, but not the only one. They are trying to replace. The civil authorities, so they would have shadow governors and shadow district mayors and a parallel quasi legal system, and of course they're attempting to win hearts and minds as the coalition was. But they're also willing to use extremely coercive methods.
Right.
Because the point is to win. So you had some limitations, that the Taliban didn't have with regards to the civil population.
Like what?
Well, there really was no end to the level of violence that they were willing to bring to bear. But they were sensitive to how to target it.
So that could backfire quite easily, right? If you're trying to win hearts and minds, and yet you've got stringing people up from trees or whatever was happening, that would work against you pretty badly.
It could. So they would target selectively. The general election was an exception where a lot of the general population was being targeted. But they would go after community leaders. Religious leaders, civil leaders, tribal leaders that were moderate or were not willing to be explicitly supportive. On the other hand, there was a very interesting program that the Afghan government innovated And it fell under the Ministry of Rural Reconstruction and Development. Hmm. Well, they implemented a policy that any community anywhere in Afghanistan could solicit funds for specific reconstruction projects. But in order to do so, they would have to meet certain criteria, including they'd have to elect a group that that would shepherd this entire project and show due diligence on the planning and the execution of the project.
Probably, and also demonstrate community support for the idea, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And this was able to operate regardless of whether or not a particular district or province was controlled by the government or controlled by an insurgent organization. And the projects that were produced by the local population using those funds, the insurgents wouldn't touch. So schools that were built that way, there was two in all of Afghanistan that were ever destroyed. And the anger of the local population towards the insurgents was so great that the when those schools were rebuilt, the insurgents left it alone.
Interesting.
And what was being built in those communities wasn't just the schools. There was an integrated community who had selected their own leaders, completely independent of the insurgents that was being built there as well. Mm-hmm. And it shows the path to success in these kind of conflicts. Mm-hmm. I think the that approach to building projects also was incredibly cost effective. It would cost them a fraction of what it would cost the international community or the government to go in and do exactly the same,
same work. Right. Yeah. Now, I find it quite amazing that it didn't matter who the group was aligned with, that they still got the funding. How could that be? That's incredible.
It was an Afghan-inspired approach, and it was brilliant.
Yeah, really.
And very, very, very effective.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, it sounds like more should be done in that direction, because it's quite open-minded and progressive. I have to move us along here, Drummond, because as I said, we're doing an overview of your presentation at Arbor Gallery on Saturday. Remind me of the date again. I should have this in front of me.
It's April 2nd.
April the 2nd, that's right, yeah. Saturday, April the 2nd starts at 7:30 at Arbor Gallery, 36 Home Avenue here in Bankley Hill. And your talk is going to be about 90 minutes, I think, with a little break in the middle. So you're going to cover a lot of ground. But let's cut to the chase here. I'm really interested in hearing, I guess I'm assuming that this is going to be a part of your talk, but is it? I want to hear what it was like on the ground there for you as an individual, and what it felt like to be there, and how much of an overview. You know, of what we're talking about right now, you had at the time, because I'm assuming that a lot of this, you know, is you've put the pieces in place, you know, with hindsight, you know, and with the perspective of distance and time, and that, you know, that really helps a lot. I mean, we all do that. But at the time, how much did you have an overview of what the forces were and what was going on, and how much of a difference it was making?
Well, I had the benefit of years of preparation, months of pre-deployment training, but really years of orientation and preparation to go into Afghanistan. Mm. And I did very intense cultural awareness and language training prior to going in. So I had a functional fluency in Pashto, which is one of the two official languages in Afghanistan.
Okay.
All of that preparation, I think, barely got me prepared for the immersion of Afghanistan.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
So I think the typical experience, particularly for those that are embedded with Afghans, is that it takes a good 4 to 6 months to get completely oriented. Mm. And I had been very well prepared. And I think Canada's approach to preparing people to going into these conflict zones is excellent. And it stands up quite well amongst our allies. Mm-hmm. And is heavily sought after by others as well. But there was a lot of nuance that it takes a great deal of time and patience to be sensitive enough to recognize.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So, at the risk of overgeneralizing Afghan culture, It takes Afghans are incredibly, incredibly patient, and they also generally don't view the world in the same way that Westerners do, and that's not a criticism. So, for instance, I didn't find that Afghans are very institutionally minded. They don't measure a person by the organization that they represent. They will take a very, very long time to gauge an individual person and decide whether or not to invest any level of trust. Hmm. And
what would they base that on if it's not the institution they represent, which is, you know, like our classically, you know, it's our title and our you know, and our role and all that kind of thing. Would it be based on other different values? I don't know, like the family you come from or the area of the country?
I think this was the challenge for Afghans dealing with a lot of foreign nationals. When you see two Afghans meet for the first time, they'll spend as long as it takes to figure out where their connection is,
okay,
however far back, whether it's family or some other connection. Mm-hmm. And despite it being a nation with a population about the same size as ours, they're usually able to get there pretty quickly.
Wow.
And that's how they really start to get a sense of who the other person is.
Mm-hmm. So that would be totally unavailable for foreigners coming in from another country. They just could not do that.
It's not as easy. They do seek other types of connections. So, you know, I met Afghans who had worked with other Canadians.
Okay.
And so this would become a prominent part of the conversation very early on.
Did you know so-and-so from
yes.
Toronto or something?
Yeah. Yes. And they're fairly adept at finding out where the likely connections are. I would guess about half the time when an Afghan would raise another Canadian in conversation with me, I did know them.
Wow.
But the approach to life in Afghan culture, which involves a lot of protocol, they're extraordinarily polite, extraordinarily hospitable. It involves a lot of slow, gentle conversation to gauge where the person is. And of course, up front, particularly when you're in a high intensity environment, the temptation from North Americans and from other Westerners is to cut to the chase. This is what we need to do, mm-hmm. and let's get on with the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And there could be a perception from the international community and the coalition that Afghans were incredibly slow and that it was very difficult to get anything done. But my experience, which reflected the experiences of virtually every Westerner that was closely working with Afghans, is that once you had made that investment and there was a foundation of trust, that they were incredibly quick with the transition to action.
Right. If you took the time to do that initial sort of connection seeking, process that was so basic to their culture,
and it would translate. So I spent 6 months developing some fairly strong relationships with some very senior Afghans and some not very senior Afghans, but that didn't just translate into the ability to get a lot done very quickly after that 4 or 5 or 6 month investment in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That also meant that your reputation preceded you when you were dealing with many other Afghans.
All right.
Yeah.
They had already heard of you from their colleagues.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, once again, I'm going to push this forward here because we are running out of time. Drummond, can you give us an idea, without spoiling the presentation, but of what you're hoping that people come away with when they go and hear your talk at Arbor Gallery on April 2nd? What would be at the top of your list of what people come away with?
Aside from having a better understanding for a significant event, in our own history,
mm-hmm.
I would like people to be able to walk away with a different lens through which to view conflicts like this and our involvement in other places in the world.
Mm.
So, you know, I think there's been a significant improvement in the coverage since the 90s of our involvement in conflict areas.
Mm-hmm.
But often the fear of complexity and the desire to explain things very, very quickly leads to a real lack of understanding or even a rejection of an investment in developing an understanding mm-hmm. Of what's really going on and the type of difference that that we can make.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our perceptions come down to binary decisions about should we be involved, should we not? Whereas some of the most important questions is fall more in line of what is it that we're hoping to achieve?
Yes.
And the detailed questions of what's at risk if we don't get involved? If we do get involved, what's the nature of our involvement got to be in order to lead to what it is that that we're hoping to achieve?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I would say that you've already achieved that goal just in our conversation today for our listeners and for me, for sure. Just gave me an insight into, I guess, how so much similar to the rest of us, you know, people in Afghanistan. Are there all people that want to live a good life and have a future for their children and be able to look to, you know, towards a future with full of possibilities rather than you know, oppression or violence or whatever? And like it's all what we all strive for, and taking the time, as you said, to actually get to know people on that level and understand what makes them tick and be able to gain some trust and trust them as well is the beginning maybe of that process that makes it maybe a more complete process. And just having that view, you know, it's not typically communicated, I don't think, in the media today. You know, it tends to be numbers and stats and as you say, a kind of binary representation of a good and bad and that kind of thing. And it's maybe overly trivializing a very complex situation. So really appreciate you coming in today to giving us this overview of your presentation coming up at Arbor Gallery on April the 2nd. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. So once again, that's the speaker series at Arbor Gallery here in Van Cleek Hill, taking place April the 2nd at 7:30 in the evening. And the cost is $6. And there will be refreshments available provided by Sam's Kitchen just next door to the review here. And it's going to be a really interesting evening. Plan to be there.